Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, KALW's program dedicated to tackling taboos around death and dying. You know, Benjamin Franklin once wrote, "Nothing is certain except death and taxes." This week marks the convergence of both. Tax Day was on Tuesday, and earlier this week, it was observed as National Healthcare Decisions Day, though this year, it's an entire week. It's an annual initiative to inspire conversations around healthcare decisions, also known as advanced care planning. Conversations around healthcare decisions are just that. Conversations, plural, more than one, always room for more. Joining me for this hour is an expert in facilitating those conversations, social worker Bridget Sumser. Bridget is my colleague on the palliative care team at UCSF Medical Center, helping to care for patients and families while they're in the hospital. Bridget's also worked with patients and families facing serious illness and end-of-life issues in the home as well as nursing facilities. And she came to this work after her own personal experiences of navigating serious illness, dying, and death with family and friends. Her priority is to meet people precisely where they are. She describes this work of accompanying people in their process as being both deeply personal and a great privilege. Bridget Sumser, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, our goal today is twofold. First, to give you, our listeners, information, a sense of the types of conversations to have, the people you want to include, and some key documents you'll want to be familiar with. Second, Bridget and I hope to be a real support to you, a sounding board or even a practice ground for you to begin these conversations. If you've ever wondered where to start or what to say or when to talk or what if no one actually wants to listen to you, this is the program for you. We welcome your calls, your questions and your experiences and your challenges. Feel free to give us a ring at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. So I want to begin, Bridget, by asking a pretty obvious but intimate question of why you do this. What is it about having these conversations that you find so important and so meaningful?
Yeah. It's a big question. Makes me think a lot about the past many years of being in this work. I came to palliative care specifically because I was curious. I was interested in the real human experience of illness and end of life. And that came out of, as you said so kindly earlier, experience with my own family and with people very dear to my heart, and sort of watching them having to negotiate so many big and small intersections over time.
Can you share a time, maybe one when you were more on the outside observing and maybe another when you were really brought into the middle, perhaps?
As these things sort of unfold, I applied to social work school with this idea that I wanted to work, you know, most specifically at the end of life, which is a bit different from what I do now, from my grandfather's hospital room. He was in a cardiac ICU and had spent much of the previous 2 years sort of in and out of the hospital. And I wrote my application essay as I watched my grandmother, his partner of 60 plus years, struggle with a decision about dialysis and continued dialysis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had no way of making sense of that at the time medically. I just knew that this man who had taught me about work and politics and really infused my life with sort of liberal ideology was sort of slowly changing into a person that we couldn't totally recognize and wasn't able to speak for himself anymore. Mm. And I just watched and tried to provide some counsel, but mostly some presence. And as a grandchild in my family, I wasn't in the position to be making decisions or suggestions, but really just to be there.
Was there strife in your family? Was there conflict as the people that were in a position to make decisions were trying to sort through it?
No, I think, and I think that's really what's so humbling about this topic, or more aptly, this world of things, which is, you know, there wasn't strife. We just didn't know what to do. Mm. And he was a man who had been through a lot over a very long time, and had gotten better a lot of times. And so to really come to that place where we had some sense or understanding or trust that this was actually different was really hard. And he had doctors that had been along with him for that journey for a really long time too, and they couldn't totally see where we were either. So there wasn't strife in our family, but there wasn't a lot of clarity in the scene, you know, sort of in general.
And so how did that ultimately evolve, and did people start to show up that mm-hmm. could be more of a guide or a proactive navigator?
So, you know, after the fact, I wouldn't have been able to tell you it was the palliative care team, but it was, in fact, a palliative care team that came to talk to us, you know, the day before he ended up dying. So very late in the game for palliative care, to kind of talk to us about what the options might be. And, you know, interestingly, we weren't actually ever in the position to totally make a clear black and white decision, because the dialysis machine that he was being supported by actually clotted and was no longer able to help him. Mm-hmm. And so that decision to continue or not sort of evaporated. Mm-hmm. And his body really told us more clearly that he was dying and it was time to be there with him in that. So there wasn't actually a clear decision moment.
And just to take a moment to clarify what palliative care is, even though you didn't know it explicitly at the time, you definitely know now.
Yeah.
And so what is it that you experienced that you can then help people who may be listening or not familiar know what this is and what
Absolutely. So I can see so clearly, you know, they sort of called us into a waiting room, and it was a team that walked in, just as it's a team that I walk in with now. And palliative care is a collection of providers, doctors, social workers, nurses, chaplains, pharmacists, depending on where you are, can be lots of people. And we come on to the scene to really help in a couple of areas. I think, you know, we are very interested in symptom management to make sure that any pain or shortness of breath or anything that's causing a person discomfort is addressed, and addressed very directly. And then we also try and learn, you know, who is this person? Who is their family? What has been going on? How are they doing? How are they making sense of the experience? And if there are sort of decisions that need to be made quickly or in the pipeline, how can we make medical choices make sense with the person in front of us in the context of their life? And then the sort of real concrete help with planning as those conversations evolve.
It's a perfect moment for me to let our listeners know that you're listening to Dying to Talk, and this is a special Ask an Expert night here with Bridget Sumser, a social worker with the palliative care team at UCSF Medical Center. And you were just talking about how to address certain questions that need thinking through, that maybe mm-hmm. we don't even know how to approach or aren't even aware are in front of us, and mm-hmm. and how different people in the healthcare system as well as in our lives can show up to help navigate that with us and then advocate. So specifically, what are some of the things that you have now thought about, given your experience first with your grandfather, but then many, many experiences since, mm-hmm. That help you think about, how do I plan for my life now and into the future when it comes to making healthcare decisions? What is advanced care planning?
I think it's a great question. I think increasingly, as I spend time with patients and families in the hospital and I hold these questions and conversations with people in my life outside of work, I think more and more that it's not about specific medical interventions that you would or wouldn't want. Although sometimes there's great clarity about that, and we can talk more about that. For me, it's about who are we? Who are you? What are the things that are most important to you? What is your good enough day look like? What's included? Who's around? What are the values and experiences and abilities that have consistently been with you through your life experience? And how do we talk about that? How do we identify that for ourselves? And how do we talk about that with the people that are closest to us or important to us, so that we can use that information to interpret medical choices or options that are presented to us at some point?
So specifically in the context of National Healthcare Decisions Day and an acknowledgement of the benefit, shall we say, of creating an advanced directive, you know, first let's define perhaps what an advanced directive is, what that entails, and then how it can be used, when it might be used, and, and perhaps even what are its limitations?
Yeah, so it's a good question. You know, I really think of advanced directives to include a range of documents that help to identify most basically and most commonly a surrogate decision maker, and then often preferences, both sort of broad and specific, about the types of interventions and medical support that you're interested in over time.
So let's start with surrogate decision maker.
Yeah.
So that is someone who would be empowered legally to make decisions for you, whomever you designate, should you lose the ability to make decisions?
Exactly. So should you find yourself in a position where you're not able to participate in medical decision making anymore, and there's sort of a range of instances where that might be the case, then a surrogate decision maker and or a durable power of attorney for healthcare decisions is a person often that you have designated to be your voice if we can't hear directly from you. And just to sort of further clarify, so a durable power of attorney for healthcare decisions is a legally designated person that you yourself have chosen and has been documented. And a surrogate decision maker is somebody that, in lieu of an official document, is asked to sort of speak on your behalf. And I will just note that laws around surrogate decision making and durable power of attorney do vary by state, and are interpreted differently depending on the healthcare setting where you are. So it's important to look into what is true for where you are regionally. But I think we can still sort of talk about it with some broad strokes.
And, you know, for many people, the thought of, should I do that? Should I fill out an advanced directive? Do I need to name someone? I mean, people in my life know. They know me. They know what to do. And I'm healthy. I shouldn't do that. What would you say to someone? What would you say to me if I told you I don't have an advanced directive, which I do, by the way. But if I didn't... And do you, Bridget, do you have an advanced directive?
Yeah, it's a good question, right on the hot spot right away. So I have an advanced directive. The joke is, like, could you find it?
Right.
Probably not. So I have an advanced directive. I think most importantly, I've had a lot of conversations with the people in my life. But sort of backing up... to your initial question, I think the assigning of a surrogate is that if you don't, you know, there are assumptions that will be made that the person best suited to speak on your behalf would be your spouse if you're married. if you were single and young, it might default to your parent. And there's a lot of really thoughtful and reasonable reasons in which the best decision maker may not be your spouse of 60 years and may not be your mother if she's 60 and you're 30. Personally, figuring out who my surrogate decision maker would be has been actually a pretty complicated thing and continues to evolve so super quickly. You know, I'm 34 now, but when I first filled out this paperwork, I was 30. I was single. I have divorced parents who don't hang out very much. And the last thing I could imagine was wanting the scene to be that they were negotiating these things over my bedside. Deep in grief, no doubt. And not sure who had more control or more input, and trying to do something equally or collaboratively when they hadn't done that in a long time. And that seemed not fair. Mm. And not what I would want for them and not what I would want for myself. Mm. And so I chose my mother. And now I'm in a relationship. I live with my partner. We have a puppy. Our life is evolving and getting more intertwined. Are we at the point where he would be the person? Not quite. So, you know, it ends up being sort of having the conversation with him and my mom and my dad, so that they have some shared sense from me, because it wouldn't be uncomplicated if something were to happen.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really key point. What you just said was that it wasn't just one conversation with a person that you're identifying, in this case, your mother, perhaps in a legal mm-hmm. capacity to make decisions if something were to put you in a place where you couldn't say what you wanted, but that it's actually making sure everyone that matters to you is aware, and that yeah. if they have questions, that there's an opportunity right now mm-hmm. to talk about, this is what my concern is, this is what my value and preference is.
Yeah.
And can you honor that? I need you to honor that.
And I think it highlights, you know, the bigger conversation that we're talking about, which is that process highlights a value that's really important to me, which is that my people are taken care of in this process as well, as much as I could do that anticipatorily, that they're positioned with some insight and some memory in their bones of my voice saying something about what's important to me.
Right. That it's ultimately your voice.
Yeah.
That they're then channeling through them in yeah. that situation.
Yeah.
I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Dying to Talk, KALW's program aimed at transforming the taboos around death and dying. I'm Dr. Dawn Grove, specialist in hospice and palliative care, and we're talking with social worker Bridget Sumser, expert in navigating the most challenging of conversations around healthcare decision making and advanced care planning. I want to remind our listeners that while we are both medical professionals, the information that we might provide in this show is not intended to substitute for your own personal medical advice. So here's your chance to ask the really tough questions. Bridget has been ready. She's been practicing. If you've tried to talk with your partner, your parent, and you get a blank stare, or worse, give us a call. 866-798-8255. Or what about if you're tired of talking about this? People just keep come knocking. You want them to leave you alone. What do? We welcome your calls, your questions, and your experience. Also, give us a challenge. 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk. I want to remind our listeners, in case you didn't know already, this Saturday afternoon from 12:30 to 3, we're going to be doing a very special live taping of the show at Mission Hospice and Home Care in San Mateo. At that point, I'll be talking with Dr. Jessica Nudig-Zitter and Gordon Kaufman, both featured in the Oscar-nominated documentary Extremis, which looks at the challenges of a healthcare system that operates on the premise that more is always better. It's a free event. We'd love to have you join us, but you do need to pre-register. You can find all the details on the Dying to Talk webpage on kalw.org. Tonight, we're talking in studio about conversations that you can have with your loved ones and healthcare professionals to ensure you get the care you want all the way through your life, through your final exhale. My guest is Bridget Sumser, social worker and expert in helping people begin conversations around end-of-life planning. We welcome your questions and your experiences at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-TALK. And feel free to email me at dawn@dyingtotalkradio.com. I also want to make a special invitation to people in the healthcare profession wondering what to do when patients or family members may reach out to you unexpectedly asking for help. We want to hear your questions, your considerations, and see how we can be of support to you. And we have an email here from a listener, Kim. Bridget, this is a good one. She'd love to hear our suggestions about how to talk to her mother. She says she will not talk about death or the end of life. She has end-stage kidney disease, congestive heart failure, diabetes, and macular degeneration, and she is on dialysis. Mm. What would you tell her?
You know, I think first and foremost, a lot of people don't want to talk about death. And I think this just brings us back to the bigger point, as much as we can, to focus on this is about living. This is about the lives we're living now, the lives we've led, and what we would hope for in our future experience. You know, I will say that it's taken me some time to get okay with that sort of thinking, that sort of felt like not hokey, but just that we were trying to make what is actually talking about death sound nice. But as I've sat with more people and practiced more, if you ask people about what makes them tick, they can talk about that. And there's a way to link that to a bigger conversation or a more specific conversation about, you know, sort of quote, end of life wishes.
We have a similar question here actually with Johnny in Oakland asking us to help him in conversations with his mother about advanced care planning. Johnny, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome to
Hi.
Dying to Talk.
Hi. My question is somewhat similar. I am trying to start a conversation with my mother. I'm 50 years old. She's 74, in pretty good health. Mm-hmm. But I'm an only child. We're both fairly low income. And I'm worried about all kinds of things down the road, not only end-of-life directives, but financial issues and mm-hmm. where's the money going to come from, what money it's going to leave me with or not leave me with. And anyway, all of this, I've been trying to start this conversation with my mom. We're very close, but trying to start these conversations has been just, it's been kind of appalling. I've tried it. I've probably been much more clumsy than I should be. But she responds either with getting very upset that I'm telling her that she's going to get, you know, decrepit and sick, or else she just doesn't have any attention for it and just tends to be like, just give me really sort of simplistic answers or just doesn't read materials that I send her. It's just like her attention just glances off this. And I'm increasingly frantic to start this conversation, even though nothing is imminently happening, you know. Mm-hmm. And she's just, So I don't know how to go about it in a sensitive and productive way.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just to start, I think you're going about it in a sensitive way, which will ultimately lead to some amount of, you know, quote unquote productivity. And I think that it's a very common feeling to feel as though these conversations are clumsy. And I think If I was listening, I would imagine they're probably not very clumsy. I think they're probably very tender. And you know, you mentioned so many things, concerns about both of your well-being over time, financial concerns, you know, wanting to make sure that you know how to do right by her. And those are emotionally loaded. And so it would make sense that the conversations are dynamic. You know, I think sometimes it can be really helpful to bring in some sort of third party and more of a structure to facilitate some of these conversations, because that can take a little bit of the emotional charge out of it. So, you know, there are a variety of resources online that you can use as sort of a facilitator. You know, there's something called Prepare for Your Care, The Conversation Project, Five Wishes, and these are pretty specifically related to healthcare decisions. But sometimes having a guide, even with scripts, can be helpful. You know, I think another layer of getting outside help can be, you know, looking for somebody within the healthcare system that that can ask some of these questions. Sometimes people respond a lot better to a doctor or someone that they feel like is a professional. And so trying to identify someone either in her primary care practice or in the healthcare system at large that you're a part of that might be able to support you can take a little bit of the heat off. And then you're both in the position of receiving information and talking about it.
Would a healthcare lawyer or something like that, would that be appropriate?
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. Thank you so much for bringing that up. So elder care lawyers are an awesome resource for these conversations, because they are really like very fact-based, and they take you through the documents. They get those documents completed. And, you know, sometimes lawyers just have that ability to do things in a less emotional way. But I think speaking to the financial concerns, too, they can talk to you about Medi-Cal over time and what that means and how to protect money. And so I think an elder law attorney would be a great resource to look into.
Okay.
Thank you.
And you said Prepare for Your Care, Five Wishes. And you listed off some
in the Conversation Project.
And Johnny, all those resources you can find links to directly from the KALW webpage for Dying to Talk.
Okay.
Yeah,
such good question.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling.
Bye.
So we have some email questions as well, Bridget, for you.
Great.
One of the biggest problems in nursing homes is the rising rates of dementia that's affecting older adults, and no family to help them make end-of-life decisions. How can this be addressed successfully?
Yeah. You know, I think to me this pulls on our need collectively to be talking about these issues sooner rather than later, from the time that we're young and we're keeping ideas of dementia or changing mind at bay, and continuing to review them with friends and family and or healthcare providers or a lawyer or someone that can help to document for you over time what you would want. I think this is a really big issue. You know, as folks have less ability to participate in these conversations and no one to talk on their behalf, doing that paperwork for yourself is really important, and sooner rather than later.
I can speak, you know, my in-laws and I have spoken at great length. They've had personal experience with one of their family members having dementia. It's a huge concern for them and something that they are clear they don't want to have to endure should that be what their future has in store. And yet having documents can help that. Certainly, we don't live in the same part of the country, so if something were to happen. But I think, again, coming back to what you said initially, having conversations with their family, with their friends as much as possible now, making their wishes clear as far as what are the things that make their life enjoyable, because who knows what it's like with dementia. I certainly personally don't. I don't not that I'm aware of, have it right now. But I can tell you the things that bring quality, and they can too. And so for my father-in-law, for example, he's like, if I can't read the paper, mm-hmm. that's telling you mm-hmm. I'm losing my enjoyment. And many other people not related to me have talked about if I'm no longer laughing at the things that normally make me laugh, a sense of humor, then that's telling you as well. The way that I know myself to be mm-hmm. is starting mm-hmm. to move away. And mm-hmm. and so surrounding ourselves with people that can recognize that and then advocate for us.
Absolutely.
So I want to invite our listeners again, feel free to give us a call. We're going to answer some more emails, but in the meantime, don't hesitate to call 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-TALK. We have a question here from Josh. He's asking, how do I ensure that I will have a surrogate who can make sure my needs are met when I'm unable to speak or communicate? What's the best way to do that, Bridget?
Yeah, good question. I think, you know, that it's so personal. It's so personal and has so, you know, I have so many questions about your life, Josh. And I think it's really about finding who your confidants are. And maybe that isn't a family member and it's not a friend, but it's someone in healthcare that can help you document and potentially be along that journey with you and to advocate for you. I think increasingly there are opportunities in the community. I think we can use the internet as a good resource to come together to have conversations. If we don't have folks right around us to have these conversations with personally, we can build community to have conversations about what's most important to us so that we can act as our sort of best advocate. And that's when, you know, the documents actually become really important. I do try and emphasize the importance of the conversation and the importance of conversations with a surrogate. But if it feels like identifying a surrogate is challenging, then those documents really end up being the living, breathing proof of your internal conversation.
Mm. They become your surrogate in a sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also what I'm hearing you say is that thinking about who that surrogate is really part of the equation. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be someone who necessarily has the same choices and values.
Yeah.
It's someone who simply, as you said, be your advocate, have your back, be mm-hmm. that confidant. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually when I was still in my training, a friend of mine approached me to be her surrogate as she was completing an advanced directive. She was married, had three children, and she was clear that her husband would not be able to honor her wishes because mm-hmm. he loves her so much that he would not be able to do the things that
yeah.
are important to her at the end of her life if that's what were occurring. And so she said, I think that you can, Dawn. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'm honored, and we need to have a lot of conversations, so I know exactly what that is. But being clear that who that person is can actually toe the line and do what you say, not what they think is important.
Yeah.
It's really about what you say, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a pretty provocative question here. Mm. Are you up for that?
Okay, let's try it.
All right. Zoe's emailing us. For those who don't know what today is, it's a pretty, in addition to converging on Tax Day and National Healthcare Decisions Week, today's in San Francisco, at any rate, has something to do with marijuana. And so she raises that in the context of what do you think, Bridget, about using different substances in marijuana, which is now legalized in California, within the palliative care approach to caring for people?
Hmm.
Thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I would love for this to be a conversation as a co-palliative care colleague. But I think increasingly in California, the use of medical marijuana and cannabis for treating symptoms is used and supported. And I think for some people, it works really well. For some people, it doesn't.
What have you seen the benefits in, when you say it works really well? What's going through your mind?
Yeah, let's see. I think I've I've been with patients who really feel that the use of medical marijuana helps with their pain, helps to reduce pain. I know I've been with people who feel as though it reduces, or in their experience, it reduces anxiety, has helped with nausea. So I think it can have many benefits. I will also say that I don't think it's a benign substance. So not everyone responds in the same way. And, you know, a lot of times the folks that work at the dispensaries are quite knowledgeable about the different strains and their benefits. And it's good to ask their counsel. And I would say it's probably an adventure of experimentation, of figuring out if it works for you and how.
I'd say that's true about any medical intervention.
Yeah.
That it is very unique and very individual, what's working for one person or not working for another. That's where you really want to be working closely with your healthcare team. We have another question here, and I think you addressed it a little earlier, but there's a request to maybe go a little deeper into the distinction between surrogate and DPOA, or healthcare agent, just to make that as crystal clear as we can for Sally.
Absolutely.
Great.
So a durable power of attorney for healthcare decisions is a designation that is really made real by documentation. And that documentation can come through the form of a living will that you would complete potentially with a lawyer and or with witnesses. Most commonly, that's completed outside of a hospital setting. Durable power of attorney can also be noted on advanced directive forms. Different versions of those are available through your healthcare system, and every hospital certainly has their version of advanced directive that has the opportunity to designate a decision maker. So really, when I think DPOA, there's a paper that supports it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
Generally?
Yeah. Yeah. And that paper, you can print it off the internet. There's no one paper.
Yep.
And you can have, as you said, two witnesses that aren't related to you sign it to make it legal, or have it notarized.
Yep.
And then it's signed, sealed, and delivered, and then you tear it up if you want to change it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's an important point, is that it's changeable. And then a surrogate decision maker may be someone actually that you deem during a hospitalization to make decisions with you or on your behalf should something change in your ability to have those conversations. But there isn't the documentation to back that up, and so it makes it much more event specific. So it wouldn't necessarily just be automatic that a surrogate decision maker translated from hospitalization to hospitalization or from hospital to nursing home. That would be a continued discussion. I think generally in my experience, if there's been a consistent surrogate decision maker, that continues to be the assumption that that's the person.
But that can change.
Things change
in our lives. Things change for the people in our lives.
Yeah.
And so I think I would love nothing more, you and I have talked about this, than our becoming as comfortable with rambling off our address as saying who our designated decision maker could be.
And I think if there's one thing, one conversation that you had, or one thing that you kind of started to toss around in your mind, it would be, who would that person be? Yeah. Who's the person who I'm down to have these conversations with over time, and I think could speak on my behalf? And that would be the starting point for me, and probably the most important decision to make.
Yeah. Thank you. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Dying to Talk. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, hospice and palliative care physician, and I'm here in studio with Bridget Sumser, a social worker, specialist in palliative care at UCSF Medical Center. And we're talking about healthcare decisions and advanced care planning. And we love your calls, 866-798-8255. If you have someone you're just dying to talk with and you can't seem to bring them to the table, what do you do? We'd love to help. You can get them on the phone and we can start right here, right now. But we have a really great question here, Bridget. Someone's asking about stumbling block I've certainly encountered, I'm sure you have, saying that superstition can be a real obstacle. Mm-hmm. You know, this thinking that if we don't talk about death, it can't happen. Mm-hmm. And the positive thinking that by not talking about it, we'll stave off death. How do you get past that? How do you get people to overcome that fear that and come to the table and talk?
Yeah. Oh, so humbling. That question is so humbling. You know, it strikes me that it's important to note that these conversations come exactly out of who we are. So that means our cultural backgrounds, our racial and ethnic backgrounds, our spiritual and religious backgrounds. And when you start sort of fusing all of those pieces of one person's identity together, it can get quite complicated how we make sense of this conversation, how we relate to it philosophically, logistically, existentially. And so that's just to say that it's really important that this can't be prescriptive, that it is so much about who you are and who is the person that you're talking to. And there are instances, many maybe, where it's not ever going to be okay to talk about death and dying. And that's okay. And I don't know that it's anybody's job to change that for that person. I think an invitation to have a conversation is okay, so that in case there's a part there that really does want to talk about it, but maybe doesn't know how to because it's so foreign, that lifeline is nurtured.
You were just talking about, you know, how you and your partner have not necessarily been excited to have this conversation.
Yeah.
And yet something shifted recently.
Yeah. So actually in preparation for this show, you know, my partner is not the first to like pull his seat up to the table to talk about end of life and death and dying. And those conversations are usually couched in, but you're going to be okay and it's going to be fine. And, you know, you can imagine I might come with a sort of lighter attitude or some crassness sometimes. And, you know, we got into it last night, and I was so surprised as I started to ask him a little bit about what he would want the end of his life to look like, that he actually had really specific ideas. You know, his eyes got big, and I said, "What does the scene look like?" And he said, "I want everyone I've ever met there. You know, I live with this man, I love him. I would never have known,
I never,
that that was something that he would have wanted. I would have assumed that would be overwhelming on some level."
What I love about that, and we have a caller I want to get to, Jean in Larkspur, in just a moment, but what I love about that is that just because someone doesn't want to talk at one point doesn't mean they won't
change.
Talk at another point.
Yeah, absolutely.
So to keep the door open. Yeah. So Jean in Larkspur, you have a question about pulse and DNR.
Pulse. Yeah.
Jean, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Hi. I don't think, I mean, I may not have come in at the beginning, but I don't think you've mentioned the pulse.
Yeah.
And the DNR, which, I mean, it's beyond, you know, do you want a big party at some point? But it's like you don't leave your relatives with a decision that they will feel guilty about because you have spelled it out.
Yeah. I really appreciate you bringing up just sort of the nitty gritty. I think we've been keeping the conversation on sort of like bigger picture things. But a pulsed is a bright pink form, generally speaking, and it stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatments. And it breaks down three sort of very specific boxes regarding interventions. And a pulsed becomes relevant when you are going from one facility or one place to another. So you've been in the hospital, some things have evolved with your care, and you're going home, or you're going to a nursing home. You're going from a nursing home to home. There's some transition. It's a particularly helpful document. And what it does is it really translates the conversations that have been had and takes them with you to a new place.
So that document is yours as distinct from being
belonging to the hospital
to the
or something. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the first question is about attempts at resuscitation. So what you're referring to as a DNR, do not attempt resuscitation order. versus a full treatment, I think, or do resuscitate, I think, is the language. And that's really a question about what kind of intervention you would want or not want at the time that your heart stops.
Right. And actually, again, our listeners, you can find links to
Absolutely.
These forms on the Dying to Talk page on KALW.org.
Yeah.
So you can actually look at them. Mm-hmm. The same thing about the pulse form, while you don't need it witnessed or notarized, it's an order, right? So like a doctor writes a prescription for something, mm-hmm. this is the same thing. When a doctor signs it, it becomes an order that mm-hmm. that the rest of the healthcare professional team members will follow. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a pulse, I think, the Pulse website is actually really great at taking you through the form, but it asks about preferences regarding resuscitation, really the nature of what we're doing at this point, what we're focusing your healthcare on. So full treatment would include ICU level of care, sort of all of the bells and whistles that there might be out there. Selective treatment is really focused on interventions that help to manage your symptoms and keep you comfortable, and maybe some additional things to kind of tune you up. And then comfort focused care is really talking about focusing purely on symptom management and helping you feel sort of as good as possible for as long as possible, but not interrupting the natural life of your illness.
I think this is also something that could be useful for the doctors that are there.
Yeah.
Because I knew someone who died, and he was dying of cancer, and he had one day to live, as it turns out. Mm. And there was a very young doctor at the hospital who was saying, well, we could do quadruple bypass because he had just suffered a heart attack.
Yeah.
Also, and his daughter had to go grab this guy and said, you come into this room now and you tell him that he's dying and you have nothing more you can do, as far as, you know, I mean, he would have died on the table if they did a bypass, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You know, but the doctor was not willing to make that kind of decision, and they sort of, you know, at least tell him he's dying, you know, because
mm-hmm.
it was hope being offered.
Yeah, I think you point to something that maybe deserves an entire program dedicated to what the challenges are for the healthcare professionals in approaching these conversations. I mean, we know there's a lot of research done that shows families and patients want doctors to be forthcoming, and yet doctors still have a hesitancy around doing that. And I think there's a lot of mm-hmm. reasons that remains the case for many, not all, but for many, and we're human beings. So thank you so much for calling, Gina. I hope that helped clarify Pulse and DNR for our listeners. And again, you can find links to those on our website. I wonder if we can squeeze in one last call with Jamie in San Francisco. Jamie, are you there?
Oh, I am. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for this valuable show.
Thank you.
And, you know, I wanted to give a shout out to all the end-of-life healthcare providers, whether it's hospice people or in-home supportive services folks. But I had a specific question, and that is that a friend of mine's mother was suffering from Alzheimer's, and she felt like she missed out on a lot of her end-of-life relationship, even though her mother had Alzheimer's, but she would sing and things, and the nursing home kept her so sedated that she felt like she missed out a lot on that. And I don't know if that's something you can even address, but for her, that was kind of, I'm calling to ask you what you think about that, because that kind of hurt her a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think to me, when we think about values, you know, it sounds to me like, and this is just a guess, but potentially one of the values either for your friend or for her mother was, you know, to be as alert and interactive as possible for as long as possible. And sometimes that means that maybe pain medicines wouldn't be used and you would tolerate a bit more pain or a bit more discomfort to sort of maintain that mental clarity. But that's actually a really important point. It's an important distinguishing point that, you know, that there's comfort to be a little bit more physically uncomfortable because you want to be like as clear and as sharp as possible. And that's not, you know, some people feel that way and other people say like, I want as little pain or as little discomfort as is humanly possible. And I'm okay if I'm really sleepy. So I think that's a really important value that you're talking about that we need to name.
Jamie, thanks so much for your call. I want to let our listeners know that you've been listening to Dying to Talk, and joining me here in studio has been Bridget Sumser. She's our social worker and advanced care planning expert from the Palliative Care Service at UCSF Medical Center. Bridget, thank you so much for sharing your
stories. Thank you. It's been so nice to be here.
For helping us, for helping our listeners begin to think about this really important beginning of a conversation with some clarity and I hope some joy. A little levity.
Please,
right? That I was saying beforehand that this is perhaps the most intimate conversation,
and
the deepest expression of love we can share with the people in our lives.
Yep.
So thank you. I want to thank all our listeners, people who've called or emailed during today's program. It's your curiosity and courage to join the conversation that makes this possible for each of us to discover what matters most in our lives. Join me next Thursday at the same time for the conversation with Dr. Jessica Nudick-Zitter and Gordon Kaufman, both featured in the Oscar-nominated documentary Extremis, which looks at the challenges of a healthcare system working on the premise, more is better. We'll be recording that conversation this Saturday, April 22nd, at Mission Hospice and Home Care in San Mateo. It's free. We'd love to have you join us, but you do need to RSVP. You can find the details on the Dying to Talk page on kalw.org. There's also where you'll find the resources that Bridget and I have been talking about in tonight's conversation, as well as links to National Healthcare Decisions Week. Dying to Doc is produced in the studios of 91.7 KALW in San Francisco. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Joanne Marr is at the controls. All the music for the Dying to Talk program is by the Oakland-based band The Kilvanes. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or, as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. You ready for some Dynamo Donuts?
Yeah.
Turn the key, put the car in drive. No one else in the world tonight. Don't know where you're going. So dark.